Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
My kind of town, Chicago is. My kind of town.
Is it still? Chicago. Good morning, Dan. And in for Amy this morning is Charles Thomas, former ABC7 political reporter. Charles.
Hey. Amen. Good to see you again.
My kind of town. you're still a Chicago denizen.
Yeah, you know I am. I'm a downtown. I live downtown, and really have for the last 35 years.
Mm-hmm. But since you're originally from Missouri, as I understand it, according to some, you're not allowed to comment on Chicago politics.
Well, so. That's what they say. But you know, it's. This has been a really this yesterday was quite a day for me because you warned me about some things that I just would not accept last week. I just thought that we had turned a corner in Chicago, and apparently we haven't.
312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line 646-36DA turnkey.pro text line. What corner did you think we had turned?
I thought we were taking a slight turn toward the middle, just a slight turn. I didn't expect mm-hmm. this to be anything, you know, revolutionary or whatever. But I thought we'd take a turn toward the center, and we didn't. It seemed like we went further to the left. And I, you know, one of the main takeaways I took from this is that a lot of people don't fully understand the ramifications of what happened yesterday. This was a complete and total paradigm change in Chicago politics. If you think about the last 75 years, the city was dominated by Irish Catholic politicians, you know, the Daleys, the Burks, the Madigans, and that's gone now. That's gone. And what we have is a new machine, which is basically public sector unions driven by the Chicago Teachers Union. And they're basically the power within the Democratic Party right now. And we're going to have to look at this and deal with this, for the next few cycles. I mean, they are the power, particularly in a place like Illinois, which allows public sector unions to make campaign contributions. And they're going to have the money. They've got 30,000 plus members who make good money. I mean, $60,000-$70,000 a year. Their dues are going to be used to finance campaigns. They're going to run the public schools, that $10 billion budget. They're going to have that. I mean, I conceded that a couple of years ago. But now they've got City Hall. They've got City Hall, and they've been on a mission for the last 25 years to do what they accomplished on Tuesday night. And they did it. And a lot of people don't understand that Brandon Johnson is a product of this effort by the Chicago Teachers Union to redistribute the wealth. This is this city right now, I think, is farther left even than San Francisco in terms of what could happen, the potential, because of the people behind this. I mean, they are avowed socialists, some say Marxists even, and they've taken over now.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. I've been saying this. This is the new machine, and the new machine operates a lot like the old machine. It's just It starts from a slightly different premise, but it's still very clannish, like the Irish are. And it's still about spoils of war. And so, you know, I wonder how much of a racial overlay there is here, because we talked about this a bit yesterday, but I want to get your take. The Chicago Teachers Union, it's not majority minority and this and that. So it's not about black and white or black and Latino versus white or black versus Latino versus white or however you want to divide up. It's just about the union. Yeah. However, who's their constituency? In addition to the members, a majority of CPS families approve of the Chicago Teachers Union. They ally with the Chicago Teachers Union. That's in part what the Chicago Teachers Union relies on when they go on strike. They won't need to do that anymore. But when they previously did, is the support of the parents and the pressure the parents put on the fifth floor. And 85% of the how many ever actual students are still left at CPS, they say it's 320, maybe it's 250. But regardless, that's still a lot of families. And 85% of those families are minority families. So it's not just the actual union membership, although that's important. It's also the families in the system, most of whom, in a confounding way, support the union. That's a lot of lift, and it's lift on behalf of this Workers of the World Unite, which you were talking about, the redistribution of wealth. But it's the redistribution of wealth from largely white to black and brown, and that's their pitch, isn't it? The pitch is now it's our turn. We're going to do what the Irish did to us,
Dan,
right?
They are using black people. They are using down the line for this other agenda, and they're playing on the black struggle, our struggle, my struggle, in order to further their end, which again is the redistribution of wealth and to change the system fundamentally. That's what they want to do, but they're using race. I mean, like you say, the Chicago Teachers Union is somewhere between 15 and 20% black.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
That's it. Now, the Latino component, you know, maybe 30. I don't know what it is, but it's only a 15 to 20% black union. But if you notice that the guys who are running the show, a guy named Jackson Potter, another guy named Jesse Sharkey, who had a little public persona after Karen Lewis passed, but otherwise they use black people out front. I don't care if you go back to Jackie Vaughn, to Marilyn Stewart, to Karen Lewis, and now Stacey Davis Gates. It's always black woman out front. But the bottom line is the white radicals are the ones who are calling the shots. And you don't see them out front, but you see black folks. And Brandon is part of that movement. My goodness, people don't understand that. I was listening to Black Talk Radio yesterday, and there were people talking about the meteoric rise, how Brandon went from being a county commissioner, being just a union organizer, to a county commissioner, to now the mayor of the city, third largest city in the country. No, he had the union behind. He's a product of that movement. He's not a product like Harold Washington was a product of the black business community, and black activists. No, not Brandon. Brandon is a product of the movement. That of this socialist movement that began at CTU 25 years ago.
Well, let me ask you this. So the pitch is, if you agree with me, what that riff, and it sounds like based on what you just said you do, then what is wrong with this pitch? Basically, it's, hey, they got theirs. Now it's our turn to get ours. That's basically the pitch, which is a pretty simple pitch.
I want to see. I mean, look, at this point, I want Brandon Johnson to succeed. As a black man, I want Brandon Johnson to succeed. I want to see a thriving business community in on the south and west sides of Chicago in predominantly black neighborhoods. I want to see that. I mean, we've got that in the Latino community. We don't have it in the black community. I want to see public safety in the black community. I want to see it restored. I want to see some emphasis on restoring the black family. I want to see Brandon Johnson do some of these things for black people. Absolutely. Because Barack didn't do them. Lori didn't do them. So I want to see him actually do some of these things. But can he do it when his, I hate to use the word, but masters at CTU are basically in the background calling the shots? I mean, they spent $2 or $3 million on this campaign out of their union funds, but and they're going to get a tremendous return, particularly when they do the teachers' negotiation in 2024 when they renegotiate their contract. But I want to see him do some of the things that other black politicians have not done. And you know, right now he's got a clean slate as far as the black community is concerned. But I want to see him navigate this, and he's going to have to do it despite the fact that his, again, the word masters are back at the union, back at the CTU headquarters. And he's also going to have to do it in a national, international environment that is questionable, but that's another subject altogether. But he's going to have those forces working against him. And you know, that basically is it. I mean, you got to hope that the guy can be successful at this point. But
listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is former ABC7 political reporter Charles Thomas. We're talking about Mayor-elect BLM Brandon Johnson and what he might do as mayor. And he sat down with Craig Wall at ABC7 to offer a few comments on the various sort of core topics, starting with public safety. We're on the cusp of early summer here. What does he plan to do to prevent the seasonal spike in crime? Here's what he said.
What will you do once you take office to prevent the spike in crime that usually happens around summertime?
Yeah, that's going to take a collaborative effort.
Which Johnson says includes hiring young people to provide positive alternatives to prevent crime.
The more we invest in young people in the immediate, the more we're going to see a reduction in crime. I mean, it's been proven over and over again.
More summer jobs programs, Charles? Is that the prescription?
Yeah, I mean, and this has been going on for the last, 30, 40 years. I mean, we talk about attacking the root causes, and I'm all for that. I think that you've got to attack the root causes of poverty and crime and such. But in the near term, I mean, you got to secure the CTA, you've got to secure the streets. You've got to make it safe for people to get to and from work. You've got to, you know, restore some order to the Loop and River North and these areas where you have such a concentration of businesses that are so critical to the city's overall economy. You've got to do it, and it's got to happen now. I make the example of a guy who lives in Chatham, who takes the red line to work at a restaurant downtown Chicago, and he gets off at 10:30 at night. He's got to ride that red line between 10:30 and 11:30 to get home to Chatham and maybe even catch a bus after he gets there. I mean, you've got to make it safe for that person to do that, and that's got to happen now. We can't wait on root causes for that.
Well, and also to your point about the business community and the need for thriving businesses, so people in the city have somewhere to go when it comes to work and work life. He said this about his proposed $800 million tax increase plan, said Brandon Johnson.
And look, we're not always going to agree on every single aspect of my plan. And that's a part of democracy. But we get to have those type of hard conversations. And I'm confident that we're all going to walk out together on the same page.
Really? It's going to be interesting to see everybody together on the same page when it comes to LaSalle Street tax, comes to property taxes at that you know, he uses the Chicago Public School Board to run cover for when it comes to a proposed city income tax he was kicking around, that a resuscitation of the head tax. I don't see everybody rallying around those flags.
I absolutely not. And there's definitely going to be a lot of pushback from the business community, which you absolutely need to make this work. Do they want to pay more taxes? No, they make business decisions, and they'll run to the suburbs so quickly, just as a company like McDonald's came to the West Loop. You know, they can move their offices somewhere else. I mean, and also in the background, there's this talk, maybe not by Brandon himself, but certainly by others in the CTU, about this financial transactions tax business. This is going to come up during his term. And some of the more radical elements now on the Chicago City Council are going to start talking about it. And they're going to start talking about it in spite of the fact that LaSalle Street is a ghost town on certain days of the week, so much so that they're talking about taking what used to be office space for financial firms and converting it into residential. Because a lot of these people now are working from home. These are some of the forces that are going to come into play. There's also national, international forces that particularly affect the value of the dollar going down around the world. And all this stuff, these are going to be outside pressures on the Johnson administration, much like COVID was an outside pressure on Lightfoot's administration. These outside pressures, you have to deal with those. So
sure.
You can't oversimplify this and everybody being optimistic about a new mayor and what this person is going to do and their plan. You know, what did Mike Tyson say about a plan? Everybody has one until they get hit in the mouth.
Michael, Southside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan? Charles, thank you both for taking my call. By the way, Charles, I don't think you made any friends yesterday at the other station yesterday.
What's that? What did I do?
The rhetoric over at VON.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But I didn't make any friends at VON.
But, hello, Michael?
Yeah, Michael, you still there?
Still here.
Yeah, so he's asking a question. What fill us in on the reference here?
Oh, I listened to the morning show on VON yesterday, and the rhetoric was pretty harsh.
You mean after I got off the air?
Yeah.
Oh no, I don't. I don't.
Morning show in general.
Yeah, I don't. I don't have a lot of friends. I mean, over there anymore. But I think I have a few more friends. But somebody's got to say it. Somebody's got to get in the face of people and give them another point of view about what's going on. I think a lot of people just don't understand the nature of what happened yesterday. I don't think they understand the bigger picture of what happened. And they just think that it's great to have a black mayor. But, you know, again, Brandon did not come from the same place, for instance, that Harold Washington came from. He didn't come from the same place. He is part of a movement in the Chicago Teachers Union that wants to, again, redistribute the wealth. And people need to understand that.
Michael, anything else?
Yeah, I got to be honest with you. April 4th was a very dark day in the history of the city. And quite frankly, we're doomed. Brandon Johnson is a lightweight. He's going to be a puppet of Tony Perkwicklum and the Chicago Teachers Union. I would advise friends and relatives to, disinvest in the city ASAP.
All right. Thanks for the call, Michael. The thing about him being a puppet, you know, I'm not convinced exactly of the marionette accusation with respect to Brandon Johnson, because he is a true believer. He is a fellow traveler. You know, Tony Preckwinkle or Stacey Davis Gates, they don't need to tell him what to do. As you were saying, Charles, he is part of this movement. He has been part of this movement. He's not 21 years old. He's been part of this movement for two decades in various capacities, including his most recent as an organizer for CTU. Somebody needs to tell him what to do. They have a program. They are a movement. He is part of it. Nobody needs to instruct him.
And check this out, Dan. How do you think the negotiation next year on the new teachers contract is going to go?
Very well for the teachers union.
Absolutely. I mean, can anybody understand that? That who is going to represent the taxpayers in that negotation?
Not that taxpayers have been represented at the table very ably for generations.
But let's face it, this is in your face.
Yes.
This is in your face, Chicago. You're going to the Chicago Teachers Union is going to be negotiating with itself.
Let me throw this out there, Charles. I want to get your take on this and other people's take, too. Give us a call, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. What do you think are the prospects that Brandon Johnson, you know, and it's tough because you got to project out and then you're going to have to reflect back, but that Brandon Johnson ends up being Chicago's Coleman Young?
Well, hey, man, you know, I got a lot of friends in Detroit, and you know the Detroit suburbs aren't so bad.
Well,
I mean, everybody. I mean, they really aren't. I mean, you know, places like, was it Birmingham?
Well, I mean,
I've been there.
But of course, I'm talking about Coleman Young's 20-year reign as mayor. He destroyed the city economically. It was a fiscal mess. 20 years later, it's in bankruptcy. So all those sins took a while to, you know, fully collapse the city, but they eventually did. And Coleman Young ran on essentially hatred of cops and hatred of white people. He famously said law and order was code for keeping N-word people in their place. And I get a little bit of that vibe from this movement.
I don't know. I think there was a lot of racism involved in what happened in Detroit.
Well, that's true. It's a different time.
I think it's different because, again, of the movement. But here's a question for you. If you had a white candidate who said exactly the same things during the campaign as Brandon Johnson said and did, do you think that white candidate would have been able to beat Paul Vallis?
Probably.
I don't think so, because he wouldn't get the black vote. He wouldn't have gotten 80% of – that white person wouldn't have gotten 80% of the black vote by
really?
Saying this. No.
Why not?
I mean, because I think it would have been more of a wash. I mean,
Joe Biden gets 90% of the black vote. Bill Clinton gets 95% of the black vote. Why do you have to be black to get that percentage of the black vote? You don't.
I'm saying that black people voted for the black candidate. They even told the black politicians who needed to be told that they weren't paying attention to them. And they were going to vote black in spite of what was behind that black candidate.
But all, well, Yes, right. I mean, but that sort of is illustrative of the movement that we've both been speaking about from slightly different angles. I mean, those politicos that are long past their sell-by date, they don't matter. Bobby Rush doesn't matter. The Chicago, but it's just like other outlets that used to matter or institutions that used to matter. They don't matter. The Tribune doesn't matter. These things don't matter. And so Vallis made the mistake of running a conventional campaign when an unconventional campaign was called for. And the endorsement game was a dead end for Vallis. It would be a dead end even if he was running against a white leftist candidate.
Yeah, I think that that Brandon, he got a lot of black votes because he's a black man.
Well,
of course.
His
black family, you know, they moved him to the West Side, and he portrayed himself as a West Side resident, which he is.
But here's the thing. I mean, it's difficult to exactly quantify this, but it was not like some unprecedented turnout. It was about where the turnout has been, if you average it out over the last several mayoral elections.
Yeah, it was a lousy turnout.
And so that's number one. Number two is, you know, he got the muscle is the key.
Oh, yeah.
The VBM program and the street muscle that CTU and AFSCME and SEIU bring, that's the key. So that turns people out, and that gets the votes in and counted, regardless of the race of their candidate. If it's their candidate and their money and their muscle, then I don't see how the outcome would and Vallis runs the same dismal campaign that he ran, then I don't see how the outcome would have been different. But I mean, I know this is sort of fantasy stuff.
I mean, I said early on that if Brandon was able to get a turnout that was in any way in the black community that was any way comparable to the citywide turnout, and if he got, and I remember using the number 80% of the black vote, he could win, and he did win. So I'm really not surprised that he won because I saw how he did it. Now, I think you raise a very good point. The street work done by CTU was incredible. They should get all the from those politicos, those that are in the game. They were brilliant. They did it. They went door to door. They knocked on doors. They found those vote by mail ballots. They said, "Hey, fill this out. Let's send this in." They did it, man. They did the work. That's why Vallis conceded, because he knew what those vote by mail ballots
vote by mail. That's not going to help him.
That's 90,000 people. He probably won. I mean, Brandon probably won 2/3 of that.
Let's go to calls. Greg in Jefferson Park. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Morning, Charles.
Good morning.
You know, I just don't see this happening. You know, I used to, and I actually went back for the first time in 4 years to a mechanic on the west side at Lake in Austin. I used to love it because I could take the train home, take it downtown, and then the blue line back. But I can't do that anymore because it's too freaking dangerous. And if I carry a gun and shoot a thug, I'll get tossed in prison for 20 years. But in addition to that, I mean, you know, he's been a part of the program for 20 years and doing all this stuff. But, you know, I don't see how he's going to manage the budgets with respect to, like, streets and sanitation, water department, all this other stuff, because he's not going to get the jobs done. And, you know, lastly, one thing I will say, used to go to Detroit all the time. When it comes to Birmingham, I know something about you. You go to Cranbrook. That's a private school. Talk to you guys later.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Verlon, South Side.
Okay, Charles, you stole some of my thunder, but I'm still going to say it.
Okay.
Last time I talked to you, I told you, black people believe in symbolism. Mm-hmm. And that's what Brandon Johnson is, a symbol to black people. He got 80% of the black vote, 40% of the white vote. I don't know how the Latinos broke yet. You give black people a pass talking about black people are being used. No, they're not. Black people want to be cut in. As long as they can get something from it, they will let themselves be used. And I told Dan and Amy this back in November. Black people aren't conservative anymore. The only blacks that's conservative is 70 years on up. But from 18 to 65-ish, they're progressive. They want this. They believe in this. And they're true believers as well in a Brandon Johnson. So you better think about that. This is where we are in Chicago.
Well, that's
thanks for the call, Verlon.
That's tragic, man.
Well, but honestly, the whole, you know, cut me in or cut it out, that's not limited to the black community. That's the culture in Chicago generally.
No, but the thing is, here's the problem. You got a black mayor, you got a black county board president, you got a black state's attorney, you got a black your lieutenant governor, you've had a black secretary of state for 24 years, you got a black police superintendent, a black fire commissioner, you got all these black people in all these leadership positions, and you look at the south and west sides or the predominantly black neighborhoods, and you see devastation. It's actually worse than it used to be. You got the black middle class fleeing to the suburbs in the city because nothing happens. You have more black elected officials in Illinois than in any state in the country. Any state in the country.
Well, and also, I mean, just to go back to my suggestion of a Detroit comparison between Coleman Young and Brandon Johnson, we may be sort of mid Coleman Young already from the previous few mayors, but Chicago, by the numbers, is in a worse financial position balance sheet wise than Detroit was before it went BK. The difference is we have a more diverse economy, so we're more able to keep the house of cards up. But if there's a continued exodus of significant business interests like trading floors and the associated banking and insurance, then we could get to BK, I mean, where the system literally seizes up, a lot faster than the 20-year interregnum between Coleman Young's tenure ending as mayor and Detroit having to be, you know, reorganized by an emergency manager. I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah. Well, and, you know, and also don't discount what's going on nationally, internationally. I mean,
well, right. If it, a know, national recession, is, yeah. The, you know, this year, I mean, obviously that's going to impact Chicago, too. And states that are mismanaged, like Illinois, are in the worst position to endure a recession, particularly when it comes to market returns and the unfunded pension liabilities. And of course, that's the you know, the yawing hole in all of these budgets from the state on down.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning is former ABC 7 political reporter Charles Thomas. We're talking about Mayor-elect Brandon Johnson, what one can expect, what people fear. How fast will he go in the direction of, well, the construct he presented during the campaign, which was very Coleman Young-ish rhetorically, that the race was about white wealth versus black labor? That phrase, white wealth versus black labor, what does that say? In addition to his previous, although during the the runoff muted hostility towards police. How is that going to manifest itself? And will there be preemptive action before such that people don't even wait to see what Brandon Johnson's going to do because they need to plot their next move now? When I'm talking about police and first responders, I'm talking about businesses. I'm certainly hearing from friends that I'm going to get out of the city now, not waiting to see what happens. Brandon Johnson on how he won in an interview with ABC7's Craig Wall yesterday.
When the city of Chicago heard my truth, they heard their truth as well.
Is that right, Charles? Brandon Johnson's truth is the city's, is the larger city's truth, at least the majority of it?
Oh, man, I feel like I'm repeating myself, but when they heard his truth, they heard a truth that has been developed over the last 25 years in terms of this whole leftist ideology that is springing up out of the union. I'm going to be very interested in watching the transition and who is appointed to key positions in the city government. Who are these
personnel
people?
Is policy, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, to a large extent, yes. And yeah. And I'm going to see where these people come from. What tradition, who are they? They're not going to be the usual suspects because, as I mentioned earlier, there's been a paradigm change here. And we're going to see people in who's going to be the airport commissioner? Who's going to be, the aviation commissioner? Mm-hmm. Who's going to run other city agencies? That's going to be very telling, and we're going to know this in the next 2-3 months. We're going to have this kind of information. It's going to happen really fast. You know, the police superintendent, I'm not so consumed by that. But I want to see who in city government. See, I think
I mean, you don't think that? I mean, why are you not so consumed by the police superintendent?
Because that police superintendent is going to have to do the same thing. In any event, he's going to have to somehow preempt the crime. I mean, and I don't know how he's going to do that. He's got to do it and do it constitutionally, and he's going to have to do the same thing. But I mean, some of the other people, it's going to give us a clue as to what kind of government we're going to have. These won't be the usual suspects because I think that's part of the reason that Brandon Johnson did not get that so many traditional Democrats did not line up with Brandon Johnson, because a lot of the jobs and key positions are going to go to people who, again, come out of that tradition.
Well, right.
That ideological point of view.
Yeah, it's also not even sort of ideological. It's just how machines work. So spoils of war. There's still a lot of hangers on from the old machine. Well, it's time for the people in the new machine to get their spoils, and that's what they're going to get.
They're going to be new people. New
well, of machine, course, they're going to be new people.
New machine, new people.
Yeah.
I think we're going to be able to tell a lot about where the city is going from that. See, I don't know that Brandon necessarily has the depth of experience in government to really find the people that we would they're going to be new people.
Well, the unions that, will help. The unions will help them.
Help.
Yeah,
that,
they'll be the HR
that's
department.
An understatement.
Yeah,
that
they'll be the HR department. Right.
Yeah.
So are you taking a wait and see attitude with Brandon? 312-642-5600 Turnkey Debt Protection Line.
I have
646-36DA Turnkey Debt Protection. I'm talking you, Charles, but then everybody. Are you taking a wait and see attitude with Brandon, or are you making your plans? Have you contacted rented a U-Haul truck? I mean, that's what I'm asking. Go ahead, Charles. Are you taking a wait and see? Are you sticking around?
Well, I have to at the moment. But, I mean, I have to do that at the moment. But that's personal stuff. But,
yeah,
am I thinking about it? Of course. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to see the city go further down the tubes. I'd have to. I mean, I just have to. I mean, right now I can't walk. I live downtown, but at night I can see the Walgreens from my balcony. But I wouldn't walk there at night. Not now. Not in my neighborhood. No way. And I live downtown, man.
Yeah, right. That's what I was just going to say. It's not like you are living in one of the neighborhoods that is that's one of like the top 10 neighborhoods with respect to violence. That,
right.
Not at all.
The thing is, what we have in our neighborhood, we have carloads of young people who ride around the street at night and early in the morning, by the way,
mm-hmm.
and they look for people who are marks. They absolutely do this. And if you're by yourself and you're walking around at 10 o'clock at night, you know, coming home from the Marianos or whatever, you're a target. Everybody knows it. So people don't do it. They go in at dark and at nightfall, and they close the door, and you won't see me until late in the morning, because early in the morning, a lot of guys who are committing these crimes are doing it between 5 and 7 in the morning. It's happening. It's absolutely happening.
Well, you just heard. I mean, the top of the hour, Mike Scott's newscast. You heard Governor Pritzker doing his usual routine of discounting numbers that provide evidence of flight from Chicago and from Illinois, Cook County. The latest being Cook County, the highest per capita exodus of any county over a million people in the country between July of 21 and July of 22, which is consistent with Illinois being in the top three for the last decade in net exodus and so forth. Chicago shrinking. Chicago, I mean, has lost 25% of its population in the last 40 years. That's not insignificant. But they rely on the Curley effect, which is it's coined by a historian about the mayor of Boston a century ago. But the idea that the more people who would provide any pushback to you leave, the better it gets. So hollow out. Same thing happened, and that's what happened with Coleman Young in Detroit. Hollow out the black and white. Push out the black and white middle class, hollow out the city, and that's a better constituency. That's a constituency you can rely on long term. And Coleman Young served 2 decades, and that's where Chicago is right now. And that's why Pritzker and the mayor of Chicago, whoever that person is, obviously it's Brandon Johnson now, but there's going to be, and the previous mayors did the same thing. Everything's fine. It's not happening. This is still a magnet for jobs and capital and tourism and so on and so forth. So everything's good. They just prop up that lie while they understand what's actually happening because it benefits them politically.
Yeah, well, there's some truth to that. Although as you mentioned earlier, it's kind of hard to compare Chicago in 2023 to Detroit in 1983.
Yeah.
Just very difficult because I think attitudes are different. I mean, you have a lot of people in Chicago right now, the proverbial white liberals who are clinging to this situation as much as, underclass people in black and brown communities are receptive to it.
Oh, I agree. I guess my point with Detroit, and I was also going to get to Johannesburg, South Africa, but I'll just encourage people to read up a little bit on the history of what happened to Joburg over the last 50 years. The point is, maybe the comparisons, of course, are inexact because the time periods are different. The dynamics of the city, particularly comparing an American city like Chicago to Johannesburg from apartheid forward, is difficult. But my point is, that urban decay, like a flight from a once great city that makes it a decrepit city, that is a real possibility. That Chicago is an international city, a beautiful city, a city that people want to go to. That is not written in the stars. There are no guarantees. And the policies that have been pursued, the lawlessness that has been unleashed, that really imperils the city in an existential way that I think a lot of people don't appreciate. I mean, including a lot of Vallis voters, too. So this isn't a binary between Brandon and Vallis, even. It's bigger than that. And, you know, Chicago, you think, like, the Chicago today I don't recognize from the Chicago 20 years ago. Well, let me tell you something. In 10 years from now, you may not recognize the Chicago of today. You think that we've hit bottom? No. There's more potential drop to experience. That's my point. Like, the great cities can collapse, just like great empires did. Trish, South Loop, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, Dan and Charles. I would just like to say it on what you just talked about the downtown. Miss Lightfoot's last gift as a punishment to the downtown people. She's bringing the scumbags to live, remodel LaSalle Street to make that into apartments. Wow. They already own downtown. Now you're going to fix them up and put them in apartments on LaSalle Street? I hope that doesn't get passed. Now, I call to say that the high ups, those up in government, know that if black people see a black face, they're going to go for it. Let's exclude Reverend Willie Wilson, because he was an old black Republican. No matter how much money he gave to people, how many good deeds he did, they don't want him. If you put a black shoe up there, and the black shoe is a Democrat, that's who they're going to vote for. This is what the government knows from the spokeshuman, as you call her, all the way down. That's what you just went through, a whole list of black people. If you put a black face up there, it doesn't matter what they believe, if they hate your mother, if they got bills. It doesn't matter what they did. If they're black, they're going to win. This is the mindset. And please, one last thing. Would you do me a favor? I've often heard Amy say, can we say that? Could you stop conceding in your mind? Who made them the rulers over language? We can say what we want to say. Just stop conceding in your brain. You've already conceded by using our Father, which art in heaven. Are we allowed to say Father? Stop. Please stop.
All Please. Right. Very good, Trish. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. What about that, Charles? What about your response to what Trish had to say about the black electorate?
Well, she's on point, but I think, too, that you got to look at the voter turnout, who's voting, and who's not voting. People have given up. And then in this election, we saw that the black elected officials have lost any juice at all in the black community, that black people are doing what they want to do despite what somebody like Jesse White or Bobby Rush or even Michelle Harris or some of the aldermen, some of the more prominent aldermen are saying and we should do. They aren't paying any attention anymore. So I think people are beginning to draw away from the Democrat Party. They're moving away from it, but they don't have anywhere to go right now. And I think that is the challenge for the Republican Party, certainly, to create to find some intersection. For instance, to better explain what school choice is to black parents. That's just one example. Where there's could be some intersection between what black people want and what conservatives want.
I would add too. I mean, you know, the Latino vote, which we haven't talked as nearly as much about. That's complicated too. I mean, you know, setting aside Alderman Ray Lopez for a second. Most of the aldermen that represent Latino wards in the city are avowed socialists. And so it's sort of the same thing. I know there's this idea that certainly Republicans have enjoyed more support from the Latino community on occasion than the black community. There's more volatility there. But, I mean, we're a long way from the saying the Latino community is sort of a center-right voting bloc or even a centrist voting bloc, at least in the city of Chicago, based on who you see their representatives are at the local and state level, where you see their vote go in statewide races. So, you know, I mean, it's I don't want it to make it just black and white, and I hate doing this I hate doing this monolithic black, white, Latino thing because there's obviously a lot of diversity of opinion within those communities as well. But I mean, it's just as all these things are, it's a multivariate equation that you're trying to solve.
Well, I think too, but the Latino vote, you know, even though you mentioned that so many of their representatives on city council, for instance, are far left, they are socialists. But you got to keep in mind that, man, I'm going to go out on a limb here because I don't have the empirical knowledge, but the majority of people in many of those wards cannot vote.
Yeah,
they just don't have the right to vote. And I don't know that if they did have the right to vote and you campaigned in front of them that they would go for a lot of this socialism. I don't know that they would.
Maybe.
And I think it's hard for anybody to really say that they would or would not at this point because they just can't vote. Look at the 22nd ward, man. I think that's where Chewy lives or has lived, certainly, in that area around Little Village, man. They had a horrendous turnout,
right,
if you look at their numbers. And the 14th ward where Ed Burke, well, I don't know if it's still the same 14th ward that Burke was the king of for so many years, but the 14th ward had one of the lowest turnouts. I think it was like 11-12%.
Yeah, but that also speaks to the identitarian pathology that has taken over the city. If I don't see anybody that's part of my tribe on the ballot, then why should I come out? Ron, Southside.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Charles. Two points. You all mentioned Brandon's transition team department here. Well, March 26th in the Sun-Times, he let you know. Quote, public school teachers in Chicago are best suited and fit to run government. That's a quote. So he told people. So now, but another thing I want to talk about, it was suggested that if Paul Vallis could get 20% of the black vote, that he should be able to win. He got 24%. So my question is, I know they criticize the black people that endorsed him. But what about, there were white people endorsed Vallis. See, something went wrong with that vote. Tom Tunney endorsed Vallis, and Brandon won his ward.
Yeah.
Brian Hopkins supported him. So those calculations or that they the Hispanics did a little better for Brandon, but that's a bigger question too. What about the white people that made the endorsements
Course, they. Thanks for the call, Ron. Of course, that's my point. Those endorsements don't matter. Tom Tunney, people in Old Town are waiting for Brian Hopkins to tell them who to vote for. Brian Hopkins, come on, these are non-entities. Brandon Johnson won 29 of the city's 50 wards, so of course he won a lot of majority white wards. And this is what you were mentioning, Charles. Too. I mean, the offals and the wealthy honkies on the lakefront and in places like Lincoln Park and Old Town and downtown. Yeah, right. Exactly. I said this during the campaign when you saw some of the polling that had, you know, Paul Vallis winning the white vote 53-43. That's not good enough. Mm-mm. That doesn't work. And by the way, Vallis needed more than, obviously now he needed more than 24%, but the projection was he needed 30, at least pretty close to 30 to win. So he didn't get the number he needed from the black community. But regardless, absolutely, absolutely. This movement that and the new machine that both Charles and I have been talking about for the last 90 minutes is driven by rich white leftists, not by, lower middle income black or Latino families. You think this is some organic movement that sprung up in Austin and Inglewood and Little Village? Of course it isn't. This is a vanguard class that is using lower to middle income, mostly minorities, as mascots and, frankly, as cannon fodder for their grand visions.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning, Charles Thomas, former ABC7 political reporter. Yesterday, Indiana became the 18th state to sign into law a prohibition on quote-unquote gender-affirming, which is a bit of an oxymoron, gender-affirming care for minors, so no puberty blockers, no mutilation of kids in the Hoosier State. Which is just another way the Hoosier State is distinguishable from the land of Lincoln. Although, as I said, based on where Illinois is now, if Lincoln were still here, I think he'd move back to Kentucky. The response from White House spokeswoman Corinne Jean-Pierre. Listen closely.
That's something for a child and their parents to decide. It's not something we believe should be decided by legislators. So I'll leave it there. In the past couple of months, we have seen a record number of LGBTQI bills, anti-LGBTQI bills. More than 600 of them have been filed in state houses. And a significant number of them have been anti-trans bills and, targeted at youth. And this is a president that has said that when these are some of the bravest people, he knows. But no one should have to be brave just to be themselves. And so this is a president that has been committed to this community, that has been committed to our kids in the trans community, to trans youth, and he's going to continue to fight for them. But again, I'm just going to leave it there.
Uh-huh. Is that right? Is the decision to provide your child or have your child provided with puberty blockers or undergo surgery, is that a decision between the child and the parents? I'm sort of pleasantly surprised the parents were included in her remarks, but is that how it works? Because I don't have kids. I just have a couple of imaginary sons that are doing very well. Thank you. But is that how it works? It's a equal partnership. And so if your 8-year old says, your 8-year old son says, Dad, I want to be a girl and I want to have my penis cut off, then you go back and forth and you negotiate and come to some sort of agreement on it. Is that how it works, the parents and kids? It's the child and the parents making the decision about whether to mutilate the child. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
You asking me as the parent?
Yeah.
It's totally, totally, totally the parent. I mean, I'm a parent of two. I have 9 grandchildren. It's a parent's decision until that child is the age of consent. And that's 18. Is that what it is in Illinois? It's just plain and simple. To me, this is an issue of parental rights. It's not an issue of trans rights. It's an issue of parental rights. Illinois passed that bill where a minor can get an abortion without the parent's consent. I think this went on during the first Pritzker term.
Yeah.
He signed that into law.
Of course.
I mean, he's taking parents out the game. And I think I know that those who support parents have done a lousy job of framing this issue. It's about parental rights and plain and simple. If you're a parent, do you want the right to control what happens to your child? I mean, they can't give my child and they can't pull a tooth, right? Until I consent.
The school nurse can't give your kid an aspirin, but without mom and or dad knowing, but that same adolescent can go to an abortion mill. and have an invasive surgical procedure done without mom or dad knowing.
No way. I mean, and I think if we frame the issue, I can't believe that parents don't would support. See, this is one of the problems I know that the Democrats have, is that they throw everything at you, everything. And if you don't agree with one of the elements, then you get canceled. You get canceled. You're a bad person. You're a bigot. You're a transphobe.
Yep.
And all that because I want my parental rights. I mean, you're anti-abortion. You're anti-woman if you don't want your child to be able to consent to an abortion on the child herself. I mean, what's up with that? I mean, I guess I shouldn't have said herself, right? But the child, right? Because But I mean this is an issue of parental rights, period. And it transcends race, class, everything. It's about your rights as a parent that they're trying to take away and give to the state.
A piece over at the Free Press. When he was 14 years old, Caroline's son got a pharmaceutical implant in his arm that was supposed to help relieve his psychological distress. It was a puberty blocker called Suprelin, and it would continually release a drug for about the next 2 years that would arrest further sexual development. Mm. Caroline, 43 years old, had been queasy about approving this, but she was assured by the psychologist at the Washington University Trans Center at St. Louis Children's Hospital that this was what her son needed, that it was the standard treatment for young patients experiencing discomfort with their sex. Instead of providing relief, Caroline tells the Free Press, her son experienced a devastating decline in his mental and physical health after this intervention. Among the side effects of Suprelin, according to a handout from the Trans Center, are mood changes and weight changes. The manufacturer's website also lists depression, including rare reports of suicidal ideation and attempt. Those are significant side effects, particularly if it's intended to treat somebody in psychological distress. It's odd. Casey soon experienced, her son, then that's a pseudonym. Casey soon experienced all of these. Within a semester, he went from all A's and B's to a report card dotted with D's and F's. Many days he found it impossible to get out of bed. He missed so much school that it triggered an official meeting about his truancy that included a circuit court judge. He also gained more than 30 pounds. During one therapy session, about 7 months after he started the blocker, he told the center's psychologist he was having suicidal thoughts. She recommended he be immediately checked into the psych ward at Children's Hospital. When he came out, he was taking several drugs for depression and anxiety. Mom felt desperate and helpless. In June of 2022, she wrote an email to the clinic demanding immediate removal of the puberty blocker. The doctors in charge disagreed, and so the outcome? The Suprelin is still in Casey's arm. Because you're one stakeholder, mom and or dad, until you disagree with the experts. Hmm. And then you recognize where you are in the pecking order, or you're informed about where you are in the pecking order, or you disagree with a school administrator. Then you are informed about where you are in the pecking order, and it's not at the top. Matt Walsh, the documentarian who did the film What is a Woman, gave a talk recently sponsored by the Young Americas Foundation that is worth checking out in totality. But a couple of key clips here from Matt Walsh, and he's a podcaster and stuff too. I'm sure a lot of people are probably familiar with him. And this is a message that he gave to an audience that included a lot of people that were hostile to his viewpoint. He makes reference in the speech to having had some trans people or trans advocates accost him before the speech. You know, the normal stuff that happens when somebody gives a speech that upsets any cohort on the left. But he didn't mince any words regardless. This is not real. This is a lie you tell yourself.
Trans ideology is the most toxic evil our nation faces today. And it must be burned to the ground, destroyed completely. Now, if you are a trans-identified person, and you hear that, you should be the most on board with this campaign. Because trans ideology has taken more from you than it's taken from me or any of the rest of us. You are a victim. You are. Just not in the way that you think. You are a victim of transgenderism. You have fallen prey to this ideology. And the ideology is wrong, which means that you are wrong. You are wrong about your view of the world and of reality and of yourself. You are deeply, catastrophically wrong, and you are on a path that can only lead to despair, I promise you. It cannot have any other outcome. Most people will not tell you this. Okay, they will lie to you because they don't care about you. Your life means nothing to them. The people who are pushing this on you and telling you it's so great and applauding it, they don't give a shit about you. That's what you need to understand. Your life means nothing to them. And your crippling regret that you will feel in the future, when you feel it, it will not faze them. You will come back to them and you will say, how could you have gone along with this? Why didn't you tell me the truth? How did you let me do this to myself? They won't care enough to even answer you.
I think that's a really key. I mean, there's a couple key points there. But the point, too, you see this playing out. The stories like Caroline and her son Casey, I just recounted from that piece in the Free Press. How much play do those stories and those people get? If you're somebody who is experiencing exactly what Matt Walsh is describing, and you need to make yourself a public spectacle to get any attention. The institutions, including most egregiously the medical profession, are doing everything to dutifully walk by people who are in distress because of these decisions, parents and children alike, distress or worse. They do everything to ignore and suppress and downplay stories of young people that end tragically, even not necessarily in death, but including in death, including suicide. Because they're ideologues, because they have a financial interest, all these trans clinics at children's hospitals, ghoulish as they are, because you have huge financial interests like the Pritzker family backing, underwriting these clinics and these medical professionals. Boy, this is a train that I think is a lot further down the line than people want to recognize.
You know what, Dan, a lot of doctors, medical physicians feel the same pressure that journalists feel right now. I mean, you got journalists who feel pressured not to tell the truth. I mean, look at what happened during the January 6th exposure of what happened to the shaman at the Capitol. And how did mainstream media ignore that? How can you call yourself an editor of a news organization and you ignore something like that? I think the same kind of thing is happening in the medical profession.
And they're ignoring
these people.
And the legal profession, since you brought up that, and the legal profession, too. I'm afraid to abide my professional ethical responsibilities to provide the defense with potentially exculpatory evidence in that case. I'm afraid to say what I know to be true, what I know to be a biological scientific fact. I'm afraid, as you say, to report on any of this, to present any dissenting views, to present any case studies that don't support the official narrative, because that's a sacred cow I'm going after, and I may end up on the wrong side of that.
You might just lose your job.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. And by the way, before, Matt Walsh, that's tough talk, and he's somebody who comes from a place of, you know, hate, transphobe, and all the monikers like you were mentioning, Charles. Well, here's how Matt Walsh concluded his remark. And you tell me if this is the message you would want to send to your child as that child is developing, or do you want to fall in with the mindless identitarian mob?
You can go to as many surgeons as you want. They cannot give you a new body. They can only mutilate the one you already have. And you know, the fact that you'll never have another identity or another body, that's okay. Until recently, I'd always thought that the slogan, be yourself, was just a vapid kind of a new age platitude. Maybe it was intended to be originally. But these days, it's taken on real meaning and real urgency. Yeah, be yourself, your actual self. It's the only self you'll ever have. And there's nothing wrong with it. Stop hiding from who you are. Embrace yourself. Embrace the truth. Come live in reality and be free.
I mean, isn't that the point? And I thought there was like a whole body shaming movement. Well, what's trans? Is trans saying be yourself? I mean, I know that's what they think. Oh, this is my authentic self. That's, you've been gaslit to believe that. It's a lie. If you have body image issues and so on and so forth, or you confusions about your sex and stuff as a kid, well, that's where adults are supposed to step in and tell you the truth. And that's what Walsh is saying. And isn't that the right positive message for kids? Be yourself, embrace yourself. There's nothing wrong with you. Janelle in Western Springs, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan. July of 2020, you had a guest on. His name was Pastor Randy Bland. I don't know if you remember this or not, but I pulled over after listening to him because he started a school in Shanahan, Illinois, called Family Faith Schools that has now turned into Grace Association Schools. I'm on the board with John Anthony from Black and Right. But after that phone call with Pastor Bland, he ended up opening several chapters. And these are the schools that never shut down, as you know, during COVID, and nothing happened to them. They got brought to court a few times by Pritzker, and the judge threw it out because, as we know, mandates aren't laws. What's going on now, there is an alternative public education. A lot of people think it's unaffordable to do private education. However, no one has ever been rejected from Grace Association schools for lack of ability to pay. And the people that listen to this and are hearing this message right now regarding all the things that are happening in our public schools with the puberty blockers and the gender ideology that is being indoctrinated on our children need to spread this to people that may or may not even have one shred of a clue as to what's going on, because I cannot tell you how many people I've had conversations with that I think are relatively sharp and intelligent that really are clueless. So if you have a grandparent and a parent, a sister, a neighbor that has no idea, you need to start these conversations. Anyone that's listening to this right now, because they don't know if they're not truly paying attention. But for the parents out there that think there is no alternative to these indoctrination government-run camps, we'll call them, there is. And it's called Grace Association Schools, and you need to look it up because it's the alternative, and it's where we're going.
All right. Thanks, Janelle. Dan and Charles Thomas in for Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and in for Amy J this morning, former ABC 7 political reporter Charles Thomas. And Charles, perhaps the first thing Brandon Johnson, mayor-elect, should do, you know, from his perspective, is get on a plane and go to D.C. and get in line for the blue state and city bailout that the Biden administration is concocting.
Oh, really?
Well, they're going to need to, because now that borrowing has become more expensive and government-backed investment instruments less attractive, some blue states and cities have some problems.
Bailout with what?
Well, there's one place where they got a printing press, and that's in D.C.
Yeah.
For example, Alyssa Finley has a write-up on this in the Journal. That's pretty good. When I provide the San Francisco example, think about the economics of the CTA or even Metra.
Mm.
Take San Francisco's 1.7-mile central subway, which opened in January at a cost of $1.95 billion, three times as much as initially estimated. Sounds like the Burn interchange.
Yeah.
The subway is drawing fewer than 3,000 daily riders, $2 billion. Fewer than 3,000 daily riders. The design doesn't make sense. Riders have to walk the equivalent of three football fields to connect to their other transit lines and take three escalators to reach platforms 12 stories underground. Genius.
Yeah.
However, that didn't stop Pelosi and other San Francisco socialists from championing the project. Because when borrowing is dirt cheap, why not max out the taxpayer credit card, which is what big blue cities have done?
You know, but it's sort of reaching critical mass now on that with, you know, the dollar being worth so much less.
Yes.
Now than it was just 3 years ago. And the fact that, you know, in my opinion, this is a subject for another day, with the Chinese making a full-on assault on the, what do they call it, hegemony or dominance of the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency. I mean, this is going on right now, and people don't get it.
Well, and we're helping them along by devaluing our currency.
Well, you know, I mean, there are predictions that this could happen, like, really soon.
Well, I mean, I'm not so sure about, I guess, you know, if really soon in, like, Chinese communists.
No,
think,
I'm talking
really
I'm
soon
I'm,
in our think.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking that the dollar could not be the world's reserve currency very shortly. I mean, the price of gold right now is over $2,000 an ounce, you know, it's happening. I think it's fast. I mean, it's not like a television program where we'll be right back after these announcements.
Yeah,
no,
not going to wrap up neatly in 30 minutes.
Yeah,
right.
But in a month, several months by the end of the year. Whoa,
I mean, well. I don't know about not being displaced as the reserve currency of the world, but I mean, again, I can see the sort of the larger point that we're a bit oblivious to the wounds we're inflicting on ourselves, and no place is more oblivious than Chicago.
We're indicting Trump when the Chinese are cutting a deal with the Brazilians, the largest country in South America, to use the yuan for trade as opposed to the dollar.
That's right.
It happened last couple of weeks ago.
That's right. Here in Chicago, just a reminder, not that we don't talk about unfunded pension liabilities enough, not that too many people seem particularly interested in it, but we'll talk about it anyway. Alyssa Finley reminds us 80% of property tax dollars in Chicago go to public sector pensions. 80% of property tax dollars. So you think your property taxes are funding a CPS? Not that you're getting much of an ROI on that, even if they were. But 80% for essentially to prop up the Ponzi scheme that they've created with these defined benefit pension plans. And I mean, it's just and remember, this is against the backdrop of Brandon Johnson and all the other Democrats, just about. Every answer they have or every question about a particular public policy issue ends with investing in people, investing in this, investing in infrastructure, investing in this. It's all more government spend. Wherever you see a problem, they have more government spend as the answer. 80% of property tax dollars in Chicago go to pensions. Chicago's four pension systems only have enough assets to cover 25% of what they owe workers and retirees, which is, as we talked about earlier in the show, Brandon Johnson is Coleman Young. And maybe, as I said, maybe he's like late stage Coleman Young, even as he starts. 25% of the state in Chicago's four pensions, 25% is what they can cover. less than Detroit's pension funds when the Motor City declared bankruptcy. Less. As I said earlier, Chicago is in a worse financial position than Detroit when it had to surrender to financial reality. Brandon, you better connect to all those money printers in D.C., huh? For more on all this and other topics. We're pleased to be joined by Don Boudreau, American economist, author, professor, and co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center. That's at George Mason University. Don, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Dan.
So the Fed is, you know, trying to slay the inflation dragon as if they can single-handedly. Meanwhile, we've got backdoor Green New Deals and a pending bailout of pension funds that are in death spirals and transit systems that are unfinanceable as well.
Yeah, and major American cities are electing people who are totally detached from reality to the highest offices in cities. It's a bad situation we're in today. We have abandoned reality, it seems. But as Thomas Sowell points out, reality is not optional. It's going to come back to bite us, as you've been saying in these past few minutes. And it will. They're going to print more money, figuratively. That's going to cause even more inflation. You described it as an inflation dragon that they're trying to slay. Let's not forget, you know this, but let's not forget, that's a dragon that they created. That thing wouldn't exist were it not for the Fed and were it not for the encouragement that the Fed got from Congress and both administrations, most recent administrations, by all the deficit spending that's going on. Inflation, I think, is only going to get worse. In terms of the dollar as the global reserve currency, I'm not quite as fearful as Charles seems to be. It's like both countries, both governments are doing their best to make their currency, make their economies unattractive. And the question is who's going to win this awful race? Just because China wants to be and has these plans to be some global hegemon is not going to make it so. A country becomes economically globally dominant by being dynamic and open and innovative. The Chinese government's moving that economy in the opposite direction with all of its industrial policy and central planning. Unfortunately, our government seems to be doing the same thing. So if the U.S. dollar does lose its status as the global reserve currency, it will be no one's fault but our own, because the Chinese government is not arranging for that economy to be dynamic and open and innovative. So we can retain that status if we don't move as fast in that terrible direction as the Chinese government is moving the Chinese economy.
Well, right. I mean, China, because it's a communist country, I mean, it's centrally planned. It's never realized the strength of its numbers. And by the way, its numbers would be far greater had they not introduced the brutal, ghoulish one-child policy for 30 years that then has now been bumped up to the two-child policies. They've destroyed the capacity that they could have enjoyed by, well, destroying lives, literally.
One of my favorite economists that most people have never heard of is the late Julian Simon. And Julian Simon argued persuasively that the ultimate resource in a free society is the human mind. Because we get our wealth from innovation, and it creates new products, it creates new methods for producing products at a lower cost and more efficiently. And what the Chinese government did with this brutal, as you described it correctly, brutal and ghoulish policy of one child is denied itself the ultimate resources, denied itself the human mind, and this mistaken notion that people are purely a drain on the economy rather than contributors to the economy. And those demographics are now hurting the Chinese independently of the government's draconian authoritarian economic policies. But of course, those authoritarian policies are making things worse. President Xi, as he's called, is much closer to Mao than were any of the people between Mao and and him. I'm not saying he's quite full-on Mao yet, but he's certainly moving in that direction. And as he moves in that direction, the Chinese economy is going to move in that direction as well.
Yeah, so Joe Biden is moving in the Mao direction, too.
Yeah,
maybe not
yeah.
quite as fast, but...
Yeah.
But I just go back domestically for a second here, because
sure.
you wrote this interesting column about even as like the radical free market guy that you are, there are buttons you wouldn't push to just end things that the government does right now because too many people would be hurt. You have to sort of do things in
unwind them gradually.
Yeah, and right, in a process so that people can adjust to a new reality that's coming as incentives are realigned to be more beneficial to the actual American or person generally. So you talk about the welfare state. That's sort of an obvious example because so many people now are essentially indentured servants to the government. They get all their sustenance from the government, so you can't just flip a switch
right.
and eliminate that. Too many people would be hurt. So going back to what I was saying about a potential blue state and city bailout, what do you say to the person that says, okay, I hear what you're saying, Dan, about the pension funds and the defined benefit plans. I hear what you're saying about the transportation, the unsustainable transportation infrastructure, these Taj Mahal transportation projects that you can't make that where you can't make the numbers work. But what are you going to do? Because we're here right now and you got tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people relying on promises the government made with respect to their pension benefits. You've got hundreds of thousands of people that rely on public transportation to get from home to work. And they can't just pick up and move closer to work and so on and so forth. So what do you do? How do you not come in and try to prop up these systems? Wouldn't that hurt too many people too fast?
It's a difficult question because, contractual obligations and government is an agent that makes contractual obligations. They should be pretty sacrosanct in a free society. Of course, these contractual obligations were made in a political process that was largely corrupt and unfaithful to the principles of a free society. It's a difficult question. I certainly what should be done, this is the easy part, what should be done is no more. You stop making these sorts of commitments that have gotten us to where we are today. Here's the button I would press, Dan. I would prohibit the U.S. government, the national government, from issuing any more bailout funds to cities and states. Let them on their own. Yes. They have these obligations to pensioners. Okay, well, that's an obligation they made. And that means they might have to cut back on some other services. Cities and states do lots of wasteful things. I'm sure they have more than enough wasteful resources that they can divert from unnecessary programs to satisfy these obligations. The federal government should not be bailing them out. The more we do that, the more we aid and assist this. It's fraud, basically. The more we aid and assist this fraud, the more it will go on, and it's going to get worse. It's like holding a tiger by the tail. You got to let it go at some point, because the longer you hold, the angrier it's going to get, and the more dangerous it'll get when it finally breaks loose from your hold. So I would definitely press the button in getting the U.S. government out of this mess.
So, Professor, give us a projection on inflation over the next couple of years.
I'm not the kind of economist to give specific projections. I think economists who do that largely are just doing guesswork. I think it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse because the economy is becoming less dynamic. It's becoming less dynamic because of a lot of the policies that are being instituted, state, federal, and local. The money growth that was put into the economy over the past few years, it's still there. It's still working its way through the economy. That's going to push prices further up. The Fed is lamely, I think, too lamely trying to tackle inflation. It's reducing the rate of money growth. It's raising interest rates a bit. I don't think it's raising them enough. So I think inflation will continue. How much it will continue, I really don't know. Will it get to where it was when I was a young man in the late 1970s or early 1980s? I think it topped out 40 or so years ago at 13, at an annual rate of 13%. Will it get that high? I wouldn't be shocked if it gets that high. I'm not predicting that it will, but I do think it will be higher than it is today. And one thing I do hope, but I'm not optimistic about, is that the Fed will have the fortitude and backbone to wring the inflation from the economy in the same way that Paul Volcker wrung inflation from the economy in the early 1980s. Volcker, of course, had the support of the Reagan administration, largely. I doubt that Jerome Powell or whoever might be his successor, however long this takes, will have the support of whatever administration is in the White House. That's a very pessimistic prediction, but I think it's true.
Well, we just had such a terrible precedent during COVID, didn't we? When now to hear the COVIDians tell it, the federal government's action under both administrations saved the American economy. So,
yeah.
So they shut down the American economy so they could print money and save it. So the the Paycheck Protection Program and those low interest or no interest forgive loans that were forgiven, combined with all the checks that were sent. So we did it. And so, hey, you know, what's another $1 trillion for infrastructure? What's another $1 trillion for green energy subsidies? What's another $1.5 trillion to bail out underfunded state pension systems? We can just keep doing this. This is what the modern monetary theorists actually believe, these ideologues. We can just keep doing this because look how well it's going.
Dan, it's even worse than Soviet Pravda. I think the people who published Pravda in the Soviet Union didn't believe their nonsense. This is American Pravda. I think the people who say this kind of stuff actually believe their nonsense. They believe they saved the American economy. They believe the economy is stronger today or that it even exists today because of their brave actions and throwing money around that has no backing and in productivity increases. They believe this stuff. And so you're right. They are convinced that if they can continue to do these things, no harm will come. The only consequences will be beneficial ones. But as I said, a few minutes ago, we are in an era of unreality. The people running the show, they are detached from reality and they refuse to see the world straight on for what it is. And the press, as you know, largely doesn't help matters. They give credence to these wackadoodle claims as if these claims ought to be taken seriously, but they shouldn't. And until we get grounded again, closer to reality, I'm pessimistic that we'll ever fully get there. But until we get grounded closer to reality, things are only going to get worse.
He is Don Boudreau, American economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And you can always get his musings at Cafe Hayek as well, blog Cafe Hayek. Don Boudreau, thanks as always. Appreciate it, Don.
Thank you.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. this morning is former ABC7 political reporter Charles Thomas. The Trans Day of Visibility proclamation last week from Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden, against the backdrop of the fights going on at the state level. We talked a little bit earlier where Indiana yesterday became the 18th state to prohibit, quote-unquote, gender-affirming medical treatments of minors, so puberty blockers, surgeries. Dylan Mulvaney. We've mentioned Dylan Mulvaney before. This is the young man, who's spent the last year parading around as a sassy female, sort of following in the RuPaul footsteps to fame and corporate endorsements. And Dylan Mulvaney got another one, Bud Light. Bud Light, Anheuser-Busch, which made a special can featuring Dylan Mulvaney's visage And Dylan Mulvaney was just tickled about it, of course. Here's the performance.
Hi. Impressive carrying skills, right? I got some Bud Lights for us. So, I kept hearing about this thing called March Madness, and I thought we were all just having a hectic month, but it turns out it has something to do with sports. And I'm not sure exactly which sport, but either way, it's a cause to celebrate. This month, I celebrated my day 365 of womanhood, and Bud Light sent me possibly the best gift ever, a can with my face on it. Check out my Instagram story to see how you can enjoy March Madness with Bud Light and maybe win some money, too. Love ya! Cheers! Go team! Whatever team you love, I love, too. Okay. Love ya. Okay. Break a leg. Woo!
Intoxicating. Kid Rock. Kid Rock responded to this story of Dylan Mulvaney's Bud Light endorsement. And what you're about to hear, just so we're clear, is directed at a bunch of empty Bud Light 32 case Bud Light packages, not Dylan Mulvaney or anything having to do with him or trans or anything else. But anyway, here's Kid Rock's reply.
Grandpa's feeling a little frisky today. Let me say something to all you and be as clear and concise as possible.
A little aggressive, but... Yeah.
I say so.
A little aggressive. Nevertheless, this has gotten a lot of discussion, and Dylan Mulvaney continues to get a lot of discussion because he has been leveled up by both President Biden and Kamala Harris as some sort of trans icon. And, of course, corporate America is following in tow. And, there may be many more Dylan Mulvaneys who try to ply this trade for status and cash and prizes. This piece from 60 Minutes Australia, it's a topic we've covered before because it's not new, but the penetration of it is. I mean, it's not static. It's getting more and more acceptance, in part because of books like Raising Them by Kyle Myers, a mom of a non-binary. I mean, that's the approach that she and her husband are taking to not gender their kids. The so-called babies, and Raising Them is a bestseller. And here's the philosophy of Kyle Kill or Kyle K-Y-L Myers. That's the mom. And again, this is not different than you will hear in virtually every school in this country.
It might sound extreme, but it's happening all around the world.
We're not trying to eliminate gender. We're actually trying to show how limitless gender can be, right? And just really helping kids find their own path to it and follow their lead so that they feel comfortable and authentic.
In America, someone who knows how it's done is gender creative parenting guru and social scientist Dr. Kyle Myers. 7 years ago, Kyle and her Australian husband, Brent, had their first baby, Zuma.
Yay, Zuma! Yay!
We didn't assign a gender at birth, and we didn't disclose Zuma's reproductive anatomy to people who didn't need to know. The reproductive anatomy that my kiddo was born with, I didn't want to assign too many labels and assumptions and, destinies on top of that.
You can't tell what your gender is by looking at your body. Gender is something you feel on the inside.
Kyle has become the poster person for this unconventional parenting style, writing a best-selling book about her own experience.
So you believe that if you're born with a penis, doesn't necessarily make you a boy?
Right, right, because... So a lot of people who are born with penises identify as a boy, and a lot of people who are born with vulvas identify as a girl. A big part of that is because they're assigned the boy and girl labels, right, and are socialized as such.
Isn't that confusing for a little child?
I think it's actually more confusing to make children think
that what the 8 billion people on the planet all neatly fit into one of two boxes?
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Debbie Hayton. Debbie is a transsexual physics teacher and journalist. She's recently written a piece, Joe Biden's Trans Foolishness. Debbie Hayton, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, you're very welcome. Good to join you this morning.
Let me get your reaction to Dylan Mulvaney and her Dylan Mulvaney's celebrity status.
It's nauseating, isn't it? But what it shows is that this idea we have that trans people are oppressed and victims and downtrodden is just not true. Mulvaney is an example of what I would call trans privilege. Under what other situation would Mulvaney have met the president and be given all these advertising deals?
And piece you heard there from 60 Minutes Australia, parents who take this babies approach to raising their children.
This concerns me. Raising children is about the child, and the child is male or female. The child is a boy or a girl. This seems to me to be about the parents and what the parents want, validating something within them. They should be putting their child first, and that means raising the child according to what we've all understood to be a biological reality, that there's two sexes.
Well, so as a transsexual person, I read your piece describing transition. How do you react to the trans political culture or the political culture that's developed around trans and your own sort of experience and viewpoints on the matter?
Well, I regret this because it doesn't help. You know, my own understanding of what it means to be transsexual has evolved over the last 15 years since I transitioned. At one point, I thought I was some kind of woman. Now I realize that that's nonsense. But in its essence here, we have with transsexualism one of several psychological disorders. To really desperately want to be the other sex is a psychological condition. And in these days, when it can be treated in some way by either psychotherapy, perhaps, or by psychiatry, or by drugs and surgery, these things are disorders that can be treated. But what we've taken is we've taken what I would describe as psychological disorders and created a lifestyle out of them. And it doesn't help. It doesn't solve the problems that people are struggling with. And it makes promises that that can't be delivered, that we can change sex. And worst of all, it creates this closed-minded and inward-looking community which draws people in. You know, the transgender community is the be-all and end-all, and it will support you and it will look after you and protect you. This is not healthy. You know, when this happens in other works of life, we're very concerned about these about groups like this. But it seems to have slipped in, again, because with transsexualism and what we now call transgenderism, nobody felt able to question it, or nobody in positions of power and authority in government have felt able to question it and say, hey, what's really going on here?
You wrote about your transition. After living this life, I know that I've never been a woman. Womanhood is not a feeling in my head or anyone else's. I was certainly driven to transition, but not because I was trapped in another body. I now realize there's only me in here and that I have always been here. How did you come to that recognition?
I think I had to learn it the hard way. And people say now, well, was it a mistake transitioning? Do you regret transitioning for a false reason that I thought I was some kind of woman? And, in some ways, I do regret it. You know, I put my family through all sorts of stress and all sorts of difficulties. But I can look back now and realize and see the bigger picture. At the time, I couldn't, and it was something I had to work through just to really understand myself. I just hope that if as we get a greater understanding of what's going on here, other people may realize sooner before they make such drastic changes to their lives, because the really dreadful thing that's happening is that people are being told they're the opposite sex. These poor children that you referred to, whose parents are bringing them as babies, are being raised from birth thinking that sex doesn't matter. All these ideas influence people's thinking and how they feel about themselves. And we need, as I keep saying, we need to return to reality. The reality is there's two sexes. We may not be happy with our sex. We may prefer to have been the other sex, however that can be. But we can't avoid the harsh reality that we are our bodies. Our bodies are real, and our bodies have a sex.
How are you received by the sort of leading, the designated leading voices in the trans world?
They don't think I'm trans.
You had the surgery. No. You transitioned from a man to a woman. The surgery, at least, and they don't recognize that.
No, because I deny this idea that we have a gender identity. Being trans is no longer somebody who has done things to their body, transitioned, had gender reassignment surgery so their body resembles the other sex. That's not what trans is in many people's eyes. Trans is having this gender identity. It's almost like a gendered soul, you know, that we have this soul within us, which is gendered, and that and this overrules what our bodies are. So that if you've got a female soul, you're a woman, despite the reality of your body, and vice versa. And because I will stand up and say I don't have a gender identity, and I don't know what it means to have a gender identity, because I'm denying that, people say that I'm not trans, therefore, because to be trans is to have this gender identity.
What would you say to people who want to be quote unquote allies, and just, you know, the sort of the sentimentality that grips people such that they are just there to affirm whatever anybody says they are, and to not do so is to be some sort of bigot?
Well, real friends get alongside you and support you, but they also point out your errors. They also point out your mistakes. They provide you with constructive criticism. So to allies, what I would say is, yes, sure, trans people, we're human beings, the same as everybody else. Mm-hmm. But if you want to be an ally, that means if we say something which is unhelpful or is untrue, you need to tell us, or else we won't learn. But to affirm falsehood and to affirm untruth, which is what people are doing, is not helpful.
What about the medical profession, your experience and what you're seeing now from these trans clinics that are being set up at children's hospitals, and many stories, cases of regret after taking puberty blockers or going the next step of surgery? You're hearing more voices about that, including from parents feeling like they were pressured to go down this path, even when it clearly wasn't working for their child. What you experience versus what you see today?
Well, children should not be taking drugs to stop their puberty, taking cross-sex hormones and surgeries. That's not for children. Children need to grow up first to understand what it means to be human, what it means to be an adult. If, as an adult, they've got issues with their bodies, then as societies, we allow adults to have plastic surgeries, treatments. We do this so adults can change their bodies. But we don't let children do this. We don't let children have tattoos, because we say that tattooing a body is a permanent mark and children can't give consent to that. We say that for tattoos, or at least we do in England and Wales, but we're allowing children to have irreversible treatments, which is so much greater. You can hide a tattoo. You can't hide a puberty which has been stopped, or breasts which have been removed. Children have been subjected to that treatment. So in a lot of cases, we draw a line between what will accept adults choosing for their own bodies and what will permit children to do. And there's lots of examples. And it's not unknown for us to say things like, well, yes, adults can drink alcohol, children can't. Adults can buy tobacco, children can't. When it comes to irreversible surgeries like this, this is not for kids.
Debbie Hayton. Debbie is a transsexual. She's Debbie is a physics teacher and a journalist. Check out her column at Spectator, Joe Biden's Trans Foolishness. Debbie Hayton, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate your time and best of luck to you.
You're very welcome. Have a good day.
And Debbie joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. this morning, former ABC 7 political reporter Charles Thomas. Charles, mark your calendar because our next big AM 560 event is coming up Tuesday, April 25th. We're calling it Beyond the Talking Points, presented by Fox Valley Coins. It will feature me sitting down one-on-one with Juan Williams from Fox News for a moderated conversation about all of the salient issues of the day, Trump indictment, 2024 election, economy, war in Ukraine, immigration, and much more. So join us April 25th at the Meridian Banquet and Conference Center, Rolling Meadows. Tickets are on sale at 560theanswer.com/beyond, 560theanswer.com/beyond. There's a VIP reception with Juan and me. I think that may be sold out, but the there are still some general admission tickets left. So make sure to get your tickets at 560theanswer.com/beyond post haste. 560theanswer.com/beyond. Thanks to our sponsors, Joe Cotton Ford and Carol Stream, Woodland Windows and Doors, Blue Star Security, and the Blue Label Cigar Lounge in Lockport. All right.
Mm-hmm. That sounds...
smoke a cigar.
Sunday. Cage match, right?
Right. Cage there will match. Be... Two men enter and, well, two men will leave, but, you know, yeah. But there'll be some rhetorical punches thrown, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
Juan doesn't like me very much. He throws a lot of shade my way, as the kids
really?
Say.
Oh, yeah. I thought you guys would be a cordial.
Nah, we do.
We do. I do a podcast every week on Monday night with a fellow named Mark Wallace, who is a, let's put it mildly, a liberal.
Yes.
That's putting it mildly.
Yeah.
We go at it. It's called The People's Show. It's on Intellectual Radio, which is a podcaster. It's interesting. I mean, but it's cordiality. I mean, no.
Maybe we'll get you guys on as the undercard.
Hey.
Hey. What about that idea?
Undercard.
All right. Well, let's talk to the aforesaid combatant. Juan Williams, Fox News analyst, columnist for The Hill, author of What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Juan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good morning. And Charles, nice to meet you. I'm going to have to tune in and see what the undercard looks like.
Yeah, yeah. Man. We actually met a few years ago when I was out reporting, and you didn't seem very interested, quite frankly. But, you know, we met, and, you know, I've been a watcher. Juan Williams follower for some time.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you, John.
Juan Williams, he used to be
I miss you on the five, by the way. Oh. I miss you.
Well, thanks again.
Juan, you used to be with what we now know from Twitter is a state-run media, but now you're at Fox News.
You
stepped up.
What was that, Washington Post or NPR?
No, NPR. NPR. That got designated. Designated a state-run media, finally.
I got you.
All right, so Juan, obviously the first question, do you favor capital punishment for Trump if he's convicted?
Capital punishment?
Yeah.
Well, there's a way to frame it, you know, like just put him in the chair, huh?
Well,
just,
I mean, I assume that's... I mean, you know, after he's the nominee and Biden or Gavin Newsom wins, then maybe you schedule the end, right? I mean, isn't that the attitude of the left, that Trump must die to save our democracy?
I I get it. So is this the fantasy, the conspiracy fantasy in the right wing at the moment that liberals want to electrocute Donald Trump?
No, I'm not. I mean, I don't maybe go to Idaho. I think they brought the firing squad back. But no. But so seriously, on a serious note, what is your assessment of the quality of the case that Alvin Bragg is bringing, the decision to bring in the first place?
I was disappointed. You know, I thought the fact that Bragg had hesitated when he first took office and people who wanted to bring the charges had just left. They quit his office in protest. And so when he signaled that he was going to do something, I thought, well, he must have discovered something new and there was going to be something additional of some great magnitude, some strength. But there wasn't. You know, he still got a basic case. No one that I know, even on the right, is saying, oh, Trump didn't do it. No, but they're saying these are misdemeanor charges. And would these charges have been brought at this point, given that the crime was committed in 2016, if it wasn't Donald Trump? And I think that's a legitimate question, although I guess not for Mr. Cohen, who went to jail, if you'll recall. And, you know, the FEC has said it was an illegal campaign contribution, you know, and, you know, I understand that. But I think that you've got to, in this case, given the time lapse, I thought there was going to be something far more substantial in what Bragg brought to the table, and it wasn't there.
So since, you know, you're an insider on that side, tell us the truth. This is all in furtherance of aiding and abetting Trump to be the Republican nominee in 2024, isn't it?
Well, I think people are quietly thinking that'll be great because they think that he's beatable in a big way. I mean, but it's not just on the basis of this. Dan, I mean, I think you're a pretty smart guy. So you know, if you look at the track record, which is what political analysts do, you'd say, he didn't do that well. He didn't win the popular vote in 16. He did terribly in 18 in the midterms when the Democrats came on in a surge. And look at 20 when he still fell short. And look at 22 when the people he endorsed fell short. So I think Dan would agree with Juan on this one, that he's not the best candidate for 24.
Well, although, you know, it's a volatile thing, isn't it? I mean, he was up a few points on DeSantis just at the turn of the year. And now as we sit here in the spring, he's opened up a big lead in some of the recent head-to-head polling. And not that I believe Biden is necessarily going to be the nominee, but right now that's where things are tracking. And in some of the recent polling, both DeSantis and Trump beat Biden. So the argument that he has to make, Trump, that he is viable in a general election, is improving as prosecutors, starting with Bragg and maybe including Fulton County and DOJ before we're done, are presenting cases that just aren't really persuading Americans that this is a matter of equal justice before the law.
Well, I think there are a couple of flaws in that soup. The biggest one is this, that the Fulton County case about interfering in the 2020 election is pretty strong, and I think that there's an even stronger case coming from the Justice Department about Trump taking classified documents and then obstructing efforts to recover those documents by the government. But the biggest flaw, I think, is this, that when you see Trump pick up the pace in terms of fundraising and as his lead over DeSantis right now, that's in a Republican primary. We're talking to the base. We're talking to the true believers here on the Republican side. And Trump defines the Republican Party at this moment. I don't think there's any question about that. He may be the largest. I tend to think he's the largest figure in American politics at this moment. But anyway, but that's not the general election. And, you got to think about, don't you want to win power? I mean, that's what politics is about. And
no.
In a general election, he looks weaker than ever.
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, some recent polling suggests otherwise. But also, too, these elections now, because the country is so divided, become base plus elections. So if you don't have a motivated and excited base, then you don't win. And sometimes your base can be motivated by the opponent as much as your preferred candidate, as perhaps was the case in 2020. But it's just, I think it's just less clear. And it's less obvious that Biden or some other Democrat just has a walk in the park if Trump's the nominee, and it doesn't make him necessarily the strongest candidate, but it improves the argument that he can make to donors and Republican primary voters. And then there'll be a consolidation after that, because I don't know a lot of Republicans that are enthused about a second term for Joe Biden.
Wait a second. You flew by a lot there so quickly. But oh, didn't you notice what happened in Wisconsin this week? I think that's a pretty big signal about the whole culture wars argument. I mean, clearly people are upset about denial of abortion rights in this country. So that's there. But the second thing that you flew by in such a hurry is that, you know, when you think about Trump, you got to realize that he's got so much baggage attached that people who are swing voters, you talked about, you know, get the base excited, but Trump also excites the left-wing base in this country to get out. But also, when you think about the suburban voter, especially the suburban female voter, what we've seen in all these recent elections is that Trump and his baggage and his rhetoric and his hatefulness and the threats of violence are a big turnoff. People don't like it.
Well, I understand Trump's flaws, and I'm very clear on that, and I'm very clear on the hysteria of the left. I'm just not so clear that it doesn't attach itself to Ron DeSantis as some sort of science-denying, gun-toting, don't-say-gay Iceman if he were the nominee. I mean, whoever is the nominee is going to be labeled by the left as the next Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot. So, I mean, again, what's the increment between the two? I don't know. And it's not obvious
to
me.
That's interesting. You mean, so you think that there is no moderate wing of conservatism in America, that the Republican Party can't be remade? You know, obviously am an old man, Dan. I'm sure you'll pick on me about that when we get together.
I'm waiting to do that, yeah.
Yes, but I'm going to tell you that I, you know, covered Ronald Reagan for the Washington Post. You know, I covered George W. Bush, and before that his dad, George H.W. Bush. And they were winners because they represented moderate, stable conservatism in America, conservative principles. I don't see Trump as a true conservative in any way. I mean, when I think about people like Asa Hutchinson, who's got in this week and said, why are we putting up with Trump? I thought, well, that sounds like a Republican I used to know. That reminds me of something.
Can I jump in here for a second?
Please, Charles, go.
You know, I think both of you need to consider that internationally, there's a couple of situations going on right now that could really affect what happens in 2024. Hey, a war in Ukraine? The situation with China, situation with the dollar, all of this stuff is going to play a role. And I think Biden has more to answer for in that regard than whoever the Republican nominee is.
Wait a second. How, given Biden's record in fighting Russia, standing up for Ukraine, holding the alliance, the Western alliance, together, I think if you talk about Biden has to answer, yeah.
Well, yeah, absolutely, because
Mr. President.
yeah, well, Bob, my reading of the Ukraine situation, which we haven't heard a lot about lately, is that the Russians are definitely asserting themselves and the fact that they are a superpower over Ukraine. And what are we going to do? How are we going to react to that? When the Russians began moving later on this spring, and what do we do? How do we do it?
Well, there are lots of questions.
That will affect.
But I don't think the Russians are winning. Let me just put it to you that way. I think the Russians are caught in a situation where this is a little bit more tricky than Vladimir Putin had anticipated, and I think China right now is having to deal with Russia as like a, you know, like a weak sister in this deal, in a big fight. They don't know what to do about it, and they're worried that this is sending a signal that is encouraging the United States to be more aggressive in defense of Taiwan.
But my point being that this will have an impact on the 2024 election and who becomes a Republican nominee, as well as how that nominee fares in November of 2024, and I think we just have to put that in play here.
Well, Juan, handicap the other side for us. I mean, what is your handle on the likelihood that Biden is the nominee, that he doesn't step aside?
I think it's like close to 100% he's the nominee.
Really? Really?
Yeah, unless of course he gets sick. I mean, he's an elderly guy, so
I understand.
That's possible.
But
short of that, the Democratic Party is pretty unified behind him. When you see Bernie Sanders, who just recently had a new book out and clearly is biting his tongue because they want Biden to be more left wing, you know, when you see Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, even Gavin Newsom, you mentioned Gavin Newsom, Dan.
Yeah,
Gavin Newsom has said he's supporting Joe Biden.
Yeah, but I mean, come on, God, these are politicians. They always say what they say what they need to say in the moment, with an eye towards where they really want to be. And obviously, Gavin Newsom really wants to run.
Right.
So does our guy here, J.B. Pritzker. They really want to run, but they're not going to cross that line yet until the moment is right. My point is to say there's no rumblings on the other side to say we got to figure out a way to sideline this guy.
The rumbling is the polls. Look at the poll numbers. There are a good number of Democrats who think they'd prefer someone other than Biden to be the nominee.
Right.
And the biggest point, of course, is what we discussed earlier, his age. So there are a lot of people who think time to move on, you know. But again, who's number two on the list on those polls? Bernie Sanders. How old is Bernie? Bernie Sanders, I think he's older than Biden.
Yeah,
but he's even
like
more left-wing.
120 or something.
Yeah, he's really left-wing. He's a socialist. He calls himself a socialist. He takes away your thunder, Dan.
Well, Comrade Bernie, I think he's more of a Bolshevik than a socialist. But here's the thing. He's number two because of two runs and because of the grassroots and all that stuff. But I mean, they can do to Bernie in 2024 what they did to him in 2020 if they wanted to with Gavin Newsom. Gavin Newsom's not in. He's not a national figure in the same way that Bernie Sanders is. He doesn't have that base that he built over the last 8 years. So, I mean, that's sort of fool's gold. If Newsom is in, you're going to see the money and the rally around Newsom, and he could clearly be the nominee if the field was cleared of Biden, and maybe even if it wasn't.
Yeah, well, look, I think, you know, and this is not because I'm talking to you, but I think there are lots of people who look at Pritzker. People who look at Jared Polis in Colorado.
Yeah, Polis
say,
is a
Democrat. Gosh, is this the next generation of Democrats, and why are we hooked up on Biden? But you know what it always comes back to when I'm having conversations with not the politicians but the political strategists on the Democratic side is, remember who beat Trump, because Trump is the big threat out there as far as Democrats are concerned. That's why he energizes the turnout. And they think, you know what, Biden knows how to beat Trump.
Hey, the election interference thing, since we're talking about presidential elections and this Fulton County investigation that's pending, what about the should there be any reckoning with the allegations? And these are from filings by the special counsel, John Durham. Yeah, he's still out there doing stuff. Should there be any reckoning for the election interference by Hillary Clinton and company? Like, for example, the enlisting the assistance of tech geeks to hack into Trump Tower servers with the prospect of setting up sort of indicia of some sort of Russian collusion. I mean, this is right out of a Durham filing. In connection with these efforts, Tech Executive One exploited his access to non-public and or proprietary Internet data, enlisted the assistance of research at a U.S.-based university, were receiving and analyzed large amounts of Internet data in connection with the pending federal government cybersecurity research contract, and so on and so forth. Tech Executive One tasked these researchers to mine Internet data to establish an inference and narrative tying then-candidate Trump to Russia. That's John Durham's filing in court. Is that if that's true, is that an example of election interference by the Clinton campaign?
I'm glad you put in "if that's true."
If
we
it's
don't
true,
know
is it?
It's true.
Well, it is coming from a former U.S. attorney. It's a court filing. He's making a representation before a court, so it has some weight. I'm not saying it's dispositive, but it has some weight. So if it's true, with Hillary Clinton, should she be prosecuted for election interference?
Well, the question is it true? And if
it's,
true, then of course it would be election. But you know what? As I recall, and I'm not up to speed on it, but as I recall, it wasn't that Hillary Clinton hired this person. It's somebody that Hillary, that was working with Hillary.
Well, of course.
Had a relation. Okay. Oh, so now you want to change the story.
No, I'm not. I'm not changing the subject. Of
but
course
I'm
he used
tell you,
cut out.
That's how conspiracies get fed. It's, and it's then everybody a, says, oh, a, Hillary interfered. But Hillary didn't interfere. Wasn't
oh,
Hillary
my gosh.
Clinton's action.
Come on. That's like, oh, yeah, so she has no. Yeah, so it's like Perkins Coie. I was like, oh, she didn't direct Perkins Coie. It was Michael Sussman. Right. Of course, all these people have cutouts. What is she managing the day to day of a presidential campaign? Of course not. But she's got servers in her closets that she wipes with a cloth, and she's got this guy doing that with the Steele dossier, and she's got another guy hacking into Trump Tower's internet server to establish this phony baloney Russian collusion narrative. But she doesn't know anything. She's completely in the dark. Right.
You know, I love this. So in other words, Democrats want to run against Trump, but Dan wants to run against Hillary.
No,
I don't want.
What I want is equal justice before the law, not prosecutions or non-prosecutions based on your political beliefs. That's what I'd like.
Well, I believe in that, and if somebody can prove that case, I'm going to stand with you, Dan. We can stand outside and yell, "Lock her up! Lock her up!"
All right, very good. All right, I'm going to make the signs. I'm going to give you one when you come in April 25th. Make up those signs. We'll be waving them. Juan Williams, Fox News analyst, columnist for The Hill, author of the book, What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? And again, in town, April 25th, Rolling Meadows. Get your tickets now, 560answer.com. Juan, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Hey, Juan, I tell you, man, you're coming in town. It's a road game. It's a road game for you.
I know. I'm worried about that.
Great to have you, Juan. Juan Williams joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J, former ABC 7 political reporter Charles Thomas. Charles, before we get to our next guest, I just have to remark on this. The Chicago Tribune is completely irrelevant, okay? But it doesn't mean it has no entertainment value. Unintentionally, of course. Chicago Tribune editorial about BLM Brandon Johnson's victory gushes over his charisma, something that, and oratory skills, something his predecessors didn't possess, and so forth. But they write this. He, Brandon Johnson, found a place for God, but not strikingly for Barack Obama, inarguably the most important leader this city has ever produced. So they're criticizing Brandon Johnson for thanking God for his victory, you know, which is fine and shows some level of humility, which is nice. He thanked God, but he didn't thank Barack Obama. And of course, Charles, you know, in Chicago, there's God, and then one step above God is Barack Obama.
Affectionately known as Black Jesus.
Black Jesus.
Yeah.
Just like Trump is Orange Jesus. Yeah, right. it's just, I just love that line. This is what happens when you have a half-ass art critic as your editorial page editor.
I know, it's amazing, man.
What a laugh riot. Classic white liberal. Oh,
BS.
What a laugh riot the Chicago Tribune editorial page is now.
John Cass, that's
a staff editorial. John Cass got out the whole thing.
Read the front page. It's got a narrative. The front page has a narrative.
Yeah. No, it's a wonderful pamphlet.
The news.
All right. Speaking of local elections and getting out to the suburbs, there were some bright spots. I like to report on the bright spots. They're not a lot from my perspective. But one of them, by the way, because a lot of people inquired about the candidates to support in St. Charles 303 on the show. Three of the four candidates I wanted to win won, and they're, you know, common sense, small C conservatives. Who I think are going to bring some accountability to the school board and also now have a majority of that school board. So maybe some things will start to change in a positive direction in St. Charles. Another bright spot in Naperville, of all places. That's where things are. You're surprised when there's anything right of Mao happening in Naperville. Josh McBroom is a Naperville-based financial advisor, and he's a newly elected city councilman, along with newly elected mayor Scott Worley, although I'm not saying they ran together, but new leadership in Naperville. And Josh McBroom joins us now. Josh, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, pleasure. So when should Naperville residents expect the public housing towers on the Riverwalk to go up?
You know, that was a big topic in town. And, you know, the politically correct term is affordable housing.
Oh,
and,
excuse me. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Say it right. On the south side of Naperville, you've got a whole lot of people that have been leadership positions in our downtown, which has become, if you drive around downtown Naperville, it's very blue. And those are the individuals that talk about affordable housing, but they don't necessarily want it by their neighborhood. And there's a lot of equity and inclusion talk from that community. And we're to the point in Naperville where about 20% of our population are South Asian, and they largely live in the south side of Naperville. And we think that they kind of woke up to this whole idea of inclusion and equity landing in their neighborhood and not so much in the neighborhood of the people who were championing it. So, you know, I think that our minority community in Naperville actually came out for our political conservatives.
Thank goodness for the minorities, because the white people are lost, I know. So where does the wind farm go?
Right. Yeah, you know, I think Naperville did make a statement. And if you look at the midterms, and especially DuPage County, deep blue. And so all of us who were right of center or right or whatever you want to call us, extremists, right?
Yeah, right.
We were concerned that we had a chance, and I do think that Naperville residents did make a statement that, hey, we're done with the nonsense. Enough is enough. And in our message, and Worley as well, is hey, we got to get the politics off these local boards. And I think people saw that, and they came out and they voted. I think we even got crossover votes. I think we got Democrats that voted for us that were just like, hey, can we just get back to city business? You know, these are nonpartisan things, right?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, on a serious note, that's what I was going to ask. Is, you know, as I understand it, you're conservative and Naperville is basically more or less lost its mind collectively. And so how did you win?
Yeah, I think that I think people saw that some of the candidates were ideologues. I mean, of course, they would call me that as well. You know, anybody that spoke up locally here in Naperville for small businesses and children to get back in school was an extremist. But
did you attack Trump? Did you attack DeSantis? Did you call for public funding of abortion? What did you do? Because I assume you weren't honest about who you were. You had to mask yourself, because that's what I understand Republicans need to do from, you know, Republicans or Paul Vallis. You have to pretend you're somebody you're not in order to win in places like Naperville.
They do tell you that, right? And I never ran away from anything. You know, there's a group called Awake Illinois that I was involved with, and which is a group that's a child welfare advocacy group. And they've been turned into, you know, if you were ever in a picture with anyone with, you know, an awake parent, you're this this monster,
right,
that wants to erase LGBTQ kids. And it wasn't in my DNA. I'm not going to run away from it. I didn't run the race with an Awake Illinois flag. But, you know, I think people saw, and I did have a decisive win. And I think it shocked a lot of liberals in Naperville. They couldn't believe that somebody like this would win. But there's a whole lot of parents in Naperville who have been effectively silenced for speaking out against what happened to kids and all the craziness that has gone on. And they quietly went into they saw Josh as a guy who really put himself out there. You know, I was elected on the park board at the time. We sued the governor over the shutdowns. And my family took a lot of abuse. And my career, and people contacted my employers, and they all saw that. And I think they all came out and they felt like, hey, Josh put himself out there. And I think it helped. I think it was thousands of parents who you know, felt like they needed to make their voice heard. And, but then again, it just, going down the line of like, hey, this stuff shouldn't be partisan. We need to stop. And we saw candidates in Naperville that got state level money. They got union money. And I think even moderate middle of the road people were like, enough is enough. Enough is enough. So
well, that,
yeah,
that
it feels good.
Yeah, that's actually pretty encouraging. I just want to restate again. So you were who you are, like the person you were on the park board, the person you were even before you were elected as a yeah. financial advisor professionally, and how you interact in school communities elsewhere. That's who you were when you ran, and you didn't, you know, try to pantomime being something else to try to appeal to this particular intemperate constituency or that particular intemperate constituency. You mentioned the trying to erase LGBT kids. That was a phrase that was used by Paul Vallis to disassociate himself with Awake Illinois because right. he had committed the crime, as you said, of attending an event to see what it was all about, but he couldn't stand and deliver. You did stand and deliver. Interesting contrast in styles and approaches.
I Scott, still think people appreciate genuine people.
Yeah,
right. I'll live and die on that. Yeah,
I think so too. I think that's the way to live. Scott Worley, the mayor elect there, said his priority is combating mental illness, bringing people together to address the incidence of mental illness. I mean, I'm all for people who have mental health issues, particularly children who have these mental health struggles because of what adults decided to do during COVID. I'm all for right. helping them, of course, who wouldn't be. But I mean, is that really the province and focus of the mayor's office, of the city council, of the city government?
I don't know. I mean, I think that Scott Worley is going to be great for the city. I think he's going to be a no-nonsense business kind of guy. And yes, I get what you're saying, Dan. I was annoyed in the campaign, especially people on the left, talking about mental illness. And it's like, why do we have a crisis? Did anyone warn? Did anyone say anything about this? Now, right. now your focus is on mental health. It's like, come on. I mean, it's something that I'm concerned about. I was concerned about, obviously, I made my voice heard 3 years ago about what's going to happen if we do this. But for me, it's public safety. Everyone knows what's going on in Naperville. Fleeing and eluding is up 500% in the last 3 years. You talk to the cops on the street.
Wow.
Everyone knows what's going on. And economic development, get back to business. Let's keep Naperville a great place. By all measures, it's still a great place to live. And we need to know that it's because we have a vibrant local economy and it's safe and we have great parks and city amenities. And that did resonate. You know, that's what local officials are supposed to focus on, right?
Actually, talk a little bit more about that, because obviously Naperville is a big community. It's not Chicago, but it's the third largest community in Illinois behind Aurora. Is that where you are?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Third, fourth, mm-hmm. something like that. And so and you've got that downtown Riverwalk, all those businesses. I mean, it's basically like a mini Gold Coast there in downtown Naperville. So what is the philosophy of policing, particularly when you've got some of these knuckleheads on the city council and certainly in your electorate? What is the philosophy of policing, protecting the business district, dealing with residential crime like you were just describing? If it's spiked that much, that people have to be taking notice.
Yeah, it's really hard to look at the stats. I mean, we just got ranked like the safest, right before the election, the safest place, large city in the state, I think. And that was
that
touted.
How much did that
right.
cost to get that ranking?
And yeah. Pritzker even retweeted it. It was nice. when I talked to the cops, they need more resources, and they're concerned. And you know, if we can't chase down criminals, what crimes are not showing up in the stats? And illegal gun seizures have spiked over the last couple of years. There are gang members that are hiding out in Naperville because of the safety. Everyone knows it. And they need more resources, and that would be a focus of mine. They need better technology. We need more cops, and you know, hey, Brandon Johnson getting elected in Naperville, maybe we'll just do signing bonuses and recruit a bunch of Chicago cops and bring them out here.
There you go, Josh McBroom. He's a Naperville-based financial advisor and a newly minted city councilman in the city of Naperville. Josh, congratulations on your victory, and best of luck on the council.
Thank you, Dan. Have a good day.
You too. Josh McBroom joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.